Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, many who struggle with cognitive decline are still capable of voting. Dr. Jason Karlowish is co-director of Penn's Memory Center. He'll talk about how to help while preserving a patient's rights as a citizen. And later on, we meet Ara D. Matthews, a Philadelphia poet and assistant professor at Bryn Mawr College. She's the recipient of a 2020 Pew Fellowship grant, and we will be talking about her work. But to begin, Halloween is less than a week away. And despite the presence of what is arguably the worst monster of 2020, the coronavirus, the holiday will be celebrated by many, though it might not look exactly the same. Experts say the key this year is safety. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have released guidelines for trick-or-treating, and yes, traditional trick-or-treating is considered to be higher risk. In just a few minutes, we'll discuss CDC recommendations to lower that risk. And also, it's a good idea to check in with your local township about individual municipal restrictions. For instance, many towns across the WHYY listening area have posted curfews or special hours for trick-or-treating, and some Halloween parades have been canceled, all in an effort to help flatten the fall resurgence of COVID-19. Our guest is Shara Epstein, medical director of the Philadelphia Department of Health's Division of COVID-19 Containment. Hello, Shara.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Of course. Let's dive right into it. According to the CDC, traditional trick-or-treating, going door-to-door and asking for candy, is a higher-risk activity for coronavirus spread. You know, obviously, with traditional trick-or-treating, there's not much distancing. What's recommended to lessen the risk?
Well, as all of our recommendations have been so far, we recommend, of course, wearing masks and physical distancing as much as possible. We also know that staying outside instead of inside is a much safer activity. So we do think that, you know, there are ways to celebrate the holiday in ways that can still be fun for kids and staying outside and maybe getting some candy, too.
Is a costume mask a good substitute for a cloth mask?
No, it's not. Unless it has, you know, three layers of cloth, a costume mask is not a good substitute. We need to still be using our cloth or surgical face masks and coverings to cover our nose and mouth.
And I've also read that it's a no-no to wear a costume mask over the cloth mask, which makes sense.
Yeah, we definitely, you know, breathing is the top priority. So we definitely want to make sure there's no barriers to that. So I think people can get very creative, of course, face painting instead of masks or decorating the cloth mask to make it fit into the costume that the kid is wearing.
But wear the mask. That's important.
Yes, okay. Wearing the mask is important.
All right. So one recommendation that I've read was to perhaps place individually wrapped goodie bags, prepare those, line them up for families to grab and go while continuing to social distance, you know, maybe put them at the end of the driveway or at the edge of a yard. If a person does put goodie bags together for little ones, guessing they need to do some serious hand washing along the way. Tell us how you think that should go.
I think as with all our recommendations, there's no big new changes. Nobody who's sick should participate in either giving candy or trick-or-treating. Nobody who's had contact with someone with COVID should participate either. But apart from that, good hand washing or hand sanitizing frequently throughout the evening and afternoon. And, of course, wearing the mask and staying distant are all the most important things.
So if say, you're preparing candy, you know, these trick-or-treat bags, wear the mask and do frequent hand washing while you're doing it. Is that what I'm hearing?
Frequent hand washing. If you're home and you're home alone, you don't have to wear a mask.
As you're preparing candy. Okay.
No.
And on the other side of this, when kids get back and they're opening up their bags and pulling stuff out, should they treat the candy any differently? Should there be lots of hand washing? Should there even be cleaning of candy?
Yeah, good questions. You know, early on in the pandemic, we thought that the spread was much more common on things like fomites, so things like candy wrappers. We haven't seen that as much now that we are 8 months in. So as long as people are washing their hands, sanitizing their hands. We don't advise, you know, cleaning individual candy wrappers or anything like that.
That would be quite a job, I'm sure. okay. So as you said earlier, Shara, you know, if you feel you've been exposed to COVID, if you're really not feeling well, just step back from the process. But what are the rules for something like the common cold? You've got the sniffles, you're sneezing, there's no fever. You know, in normal times, most of us would just push through. Did you have to hang back as well with something like this?
You know, unfortunately this year, I think you do. We have to be very careful because we know that COVID-19 presents differently across groups of people, especially in children. We can see very mild diseases. So this year, absolutely, if even just a cold would mean probably skipping out on the trick-or-treating, unfortunately.
Okay. Costume parties, lots of folks like to hold them. If you're going to go ahead with this, what are best ways, what are the parameters if you decide to have a costume party?
So we advise against any gatherings. You know, it's much safer to just stay with your family. Maybe, you know, walk down your street and pick up candy from a few houses. Much safer than costume parties. If there are going to be any sort of gatherings, outdoors is always safer than indoors. And the guidelines on our website in terms of how many people are allowed in a space should be followed.
And what are those guidelines?
So it depends on whether it's an indoor space or an outdoor space. But it's about 10% of a maximum occupancy in an indoor space and 20% in an outdoor space for smaller groups. But again, we really advise against any sort of gathering with people outside of your family.
Well, I know, for instance, the day after Halloween, it's a Dia de los Muertos for many who celebrate this. It's a time of having family over, preparing food. If people feel they really want to do something for this sort of a gathering, even ahead of Thanksgiving, small groups, immediate family, what are your thoughts here?
Again, you know, it's this year it's going to look different, unfortunately. Really trying to keep gatherings within members of the household, remotely gather with outside members. You know, we've all gotten better at Zoom. And if there are going to be any kinds of gatherings, keep them small, keep wearing masks, and keep them outdoors.
Okay. Some haunted house attractions, like Eastern State Penitentiary, are open this year. Shara, screaming is a big part of Halloween fun. It's probably also not the best thing to do this year.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. We do not... screaming can definitely make it a little easier to spread COVID. So, you know, it's another thing that's hard to miss. But again, you know, staying outdoors is better. With minimal numbers of people following the occupancy guidelines that we have and wearing masks, certain haunted houses are being opened and are allowed.
Yeah. I see signs all over the place for attractions. And, you know, and this is a question you might not be able to answer, but if you have a mask on and you're screaming, does that help to contain whatever else, you know, what might be coming out in terms of viral infection?
That's a good question. And, you know, it should. It's not, but we know that all of our measures work together. So a mask would help, but staying far away is also important, you know, staying more than 6 feet away and things like that.
Okay. Always a good idea to keep a hand sanitizer close by. How do you know if a sanitizer is a good one, one that will hopefully kill the virus on contact?
Good question. You know, most of the ones I think being marketed are good. We look at for more than 70% alcohol content. But you know, it's much easier to find hand sanitizer now than it was 7 months back. And if you go to any drugstores or pharmacies, you should be able to find good hand sanitizer that will work to kill the coronavirus.
Okay, so 70% you're thinking is a good benchmark. without alcohol. Okay.
Yes.
So, you know, we're experiencing apparently the predicted fall surge in coronavirus cases. Were you expecting this, Shara Epstein?
You know, that's a good question. We're obviously hoping not to see it, but people have, of course, gotten tired of, you know, following all the guidance for the past 7 months and putting their lives on hold. So I think people have led off on a lot of these things, and kind of as predicted, as we started pulling back from staying home and staying, you know, with just our households, we've started to see more and more cases.
And this is within the Philadelphia area you're referring to?
We're seeing them within the Philadelphia area, within the state, and within the country and world. You know, we were hoping that we wouldn't see it, but it's not a surprise.
Okay. And as you referenced, we're all COVID weary. It's easy to let our guard down. What do we need to remember to stay as safe as possible as this pandemic plays out? And what attitude and all this weariness do we need to bring into this, Shara?
Yeah, those are great questions. I think in terms of attitudes, we just need to remember that this isn't forever, and we're really trying to protect our friends, family, and the most vulnerable among the population.
Oh, I wonder if
you know that. I'm sorry.
You know what? You dropped out there for a second. Could you just kind of pick up the thread again, trying to protect our family, our friends?
And just the most vulnerable members of our population. We just, you know, it's not forever, but we need to work for, you know, a while longer still to protect these people. And the ways, you know, we can still do that. But we know now wearing masks is hugely helpful and staying physically distant. And we can still have some fun while we do that, like, you know, outdoor activities on Halloween. You know, we can still provide fun to our kids and our families while protecting everyone.
Any favorite activities of yours that you'd like to recommend?
You know, I've seen something I think is really creative. A lot of people are doing like scavenger hunts for Halloween. So instead of going door to door, families are making maps of their neighborhood and then with their households, looking for jack-o'-lanterns or decorations, and then at the end of the evening coming home and giving their kids a bag of candy so that they still get to walk around and experience some of the fun of Halloween without, you know, more of the direct contact.
All right, great idea.
Definitely.
And important information. Shara Epstein, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Shara is the Philadelphia Department of Health's Medical Director of the Division of COVID-19 Containment. Up next, we hear about advocating for the voting rights of patients who have dementia. Stay tuned.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. As many of us grapple with voting decisions in the final week before the election, one group is facing steeper challenges than most. People with dementia are often left out of the voting process, even though they legally have the right to vote. Jason Karlowish is co-director of Penn's Memory Center, and his research has found that many people with cognitive decline are frequently disenfranchised due to the actions of well-meaning caregivers or nursing home staff who don't believe the person in question is capable of voting. But this is not always the case, and Karlowish is looking to change the narrative and make certain those with dementia who want to vote and who are up to the task, perhaps with some help, have the opportunity to do so. It's a critical question, particularly in an election in which even a small change in the numbers can swing the nation in one direction or another. Calls or questions? Here's the number, 888-477-9499. Send us an email to radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Jason Karlowicz, it's great to have you with us again.
It's good to be back, Mary. Good morning.
Good morning. You know, when we discuss disenfranchisement and the challenges facing various groups of people, those with cognitive decline are almost never included in the conversation, and yet they do have the right to vote. Jason, is this because there's a blanket assumption that people with dementia are simply not capable?
Yeah, no question that there's probably two broad barriers. One is the misperception that a diagnosis of dementia means someone's not capable of most of the activities that sort of define who we are as adults. And that just simply isn't true. I mean, remember when Ronald Reagan was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease at the Mayo Clinic? I believe a week before he told the nation his diagnosis, he celebrated his birthday with a speech at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel and came off quite nicely doing that speech. That's just an example.
So when it comes to voting, give us a hypothetical, a case in which a person with dementia can participate in the process, but a caregiver might mistakenly think otherwise.
Yeah, so that brings the second challenge in particular, which is individuals who live in long-term care settings, such as a nursing home. And several years ago, in 2007, we did a study of voting in the Philadelphia area nursing homes. This is a mayor's race. And we contacted the homes to find out after the election, how did voting unfold? And one of the things among several that we discovered was that the staff, well-meaning, certainly, were sort of asking people not just simply, do you want to vote, but then following up with questions like, well, who's running and what day of the week is today? And, you know, based on the answers to those would sort of decide whether they'd go ahead and let the person who said they wanted to vote, vote. So they were essentially disenfranchising people. The other means of disenfranchisement that occurs less actively but passively is, you know, once you move into a facility, you may not be able to go vote at the place you usually voted. And so you've got to obtain an absentee ballot and or be transported to the place to vote. And, of course, both of those require assistance. And for persons with disabilities, physical and cognitive, those are tough things to do.
The Memory Center has partnered with the American Bar Association in producing a guide for caregivers, helping those with cognitive impairment, you know, to vote. And it opens by saying the right to vote is one of the most sacred privileges in a representative democracy, and it should be available to all citizens, whether they are cognitively impaired or unimpaired. Evaluating a person's capacity to vote outside the voting process itself is inappropriate and should not be done except by a court authorized to do so. When is it appropriate to take this to court?
I'm hesitating because I'm wondering when, if ever. I would think rarely, if ever. There are some states which, as part of guardianship statutes, include a decision about the right to vote and will take away the right to vote under guardianship. Many states don't have that. Many countries don't have that. Canada, for example, does not have any standard for what it means to be competent to vote. U.S. laws are more of a patchwork around voting, unfortunately. But, you know, voting, the capacity to vote, the ability to vote is a performative capacity. If someone says, I want to vote, the next step is to get them the ballot, get them to the ballot, and let them vote. Some people, of course, may need assistance, and we should talk about that. But the lack of the ability to make a choice in the end says, well, this person just isn't voting. There's no test prior to that that you could implement or should implement to decide before I give you the ballot whether you can vote or not vote. So if, of course, you want to vote.
If a person doesn't know what year it is, if a person doesn't know who the president is, you still offer them the choice. You ask them if you want to vote. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's correct.
And so then how does the caregiver proceed? Do they explain the election? I mean, what's next?
Yeah, well, let's think about this. You know, outside of the moment when the ballot is there, we all talk about the election probably too much. And you can have as many conversations as you want. But let's now go to that moment when the ballot is before you. You're in the booth with someone or seated at the kitchen table with their paper ballot and that blue or black inked pen, and you're ready to help them mark it. Yeah. Well, first of all, the question is, yep, here's your ballot, either in the booth or on the kitchen table. Go for it. And or do you need any assistance? And so, well, yeah, actually, I do need assistance because, you know, the font size is such that I can't read it. You know, ballots are visually confusing for even normal people. Witness the famous butterfly ballot of Florida that led to the debacle of 2000, and the rest is history. Well, anyway, so you've got someone to help you. So how do you help someone vote? And at that point, it really is, you're essentially an extension of their eyes and their hand, if you will. And your goal is to read them what's on the ballot and then say, which of those people choices would you like to pick? And if their answer is, I don't know, I don't want to pick one, you move on to the next race. That undervoting is common in races, you know. And following up on your key question, if they say, well, I don't know, who do you think I should vote for? The answer again is, I'm here simply to implement who you want to vote for. Who would you like to vote for?
So, and let me just jump in for a second on that point. If the person who is helping the other person to vote, they know that person, say, has voted a straight party ticket their entire lives, they don't just make the decision then to say, I know this is what so and so would want, and ask, and then help them to mark those names off?
That's correct. That's right. We don't delegate voting rights to other people, just as we don't delegate jury rights to other people. So, for example, you know, my spouse gets called to jury duty and says, hey, Jason, you know, you go on jury duty for me. You'll know how I would vote. No, you can't do that. You can't, if you get drafted to serve in the Army, you can't say, well, I'm going to have someone else go in my place. And rights of citizenship can't be delegated. And so voting is one of those core rights of citizenship, and you can't delegate it to someone else, and someone else can't say, oh, I'll take it on for him. So that's just a no-go. It just violates a core constitutional premise.
Okay. So, and how should a caregiver approach the process when a loved one might be having trouble with communication? They have trouble finding the words, even yes or no, or maybe they have to gesture as opposed to speaking, or maybe they even lose focus during the process.
Well, you know, a good dear colleague of mine, Judith Kozlowski, was profiled helping her father vote, and it took her a couple sessions to go through what was a long and complicated ballot. Americans love big ballots. We love to have lots of races, and so the ballots could become daunting with races and questions. And so she broke it up into a series of steps. You know, having said that, you know, because of problems with communication, attention, concentration, it's entirely possible that people will say, I just don't follow what you're telling me, particularly like ballot questions, for example.
Yeah.
And again, if someone can't make a choice, you move on. You just simply skip that race. You skip that ballot question, and you move on to the next race and the next ballot question.
So the caregiver does not have to push on to the end. It's okay to leave the ballot partially marked.
Sure. Yeah. Undervoting is not, it's quite common. In other words, in any given election, you'll see, you know, the marquee races get most, you know, 100% of all votes cast are cast for one or more candidates. But as you go down the ballot to things like, you know, coroner and sheriff and whatnot, you'll often find half of the people who voted didn't vote for that race because they don't have any opinion or choice. So skip it. That's totally common.
Okay. Lines are open, 888-477-9499. We've got Donald in Plainview with us now, and welcome to the Regional Roundup, Donald.
Well, thank you. I was listening to your show, and I understand it's about people with dementia being able to vote. The thing is, with like the attendants there at the nursing home or assisted living facility, they may take advantage of the person and just get them to coerce them into a vote that they don't really want to make against their wishes. And they may not point out all the issues that are on the ballot, such as legalized marijuana or prison reform or something like that. And they don't know what the person with dementia doesn't know what they're talking about. And so it isn't really a vote from the person with dementia. It's a vote for the person who's trying to coerce them into a vote.
All right, Donald, thank you very much for the call. And Jason, he's got a valid point, doesn't he?
Well, a couple points there, really two. One is, who could provide assistance to a voter, say a voter in a long-term care facility? And some states, unfortunately, have passed laws that forbid staff in a long-term care facility to assist a voter. North Carolina is one of them. Elsewhere, though, in the United States, anyone, where regardless of where you live, can ask anyone to assist them with voting. The one exception is your employer or your union representative, which is interesting. But, you know, when it comes to enforcing basic constitutional rights, we need to be keep to the 14th Amendment, which is equal protection under the law. And I can walk into a voting booth and ask anyone to assist me. And so, too, I can do that, you know, in a long-term care facility. The point about the staff exhibiting undue influence is certainly a point, and it's legitimate. Many states, appropriately, the entire country of Australia, for as well, have what's called mobile polling, where the elections officials go to congregate living settings and the elections officials administer the ballot. My view is until the United States wants to offer that routinely, it would be inappropriate to then say, well, we're not going to bring the ballot to the long-term care facility, and we're going to limit the right of people to vote in long-term care facilities because of the concern of undue influence. I think that that is just precisely the kind of behavior that is unconstitutional and disrespects the dignity of individuals in long-term care facilities. Donald's other point was the staff sort of getting people to vote, the people voting for reasons that don't make sense. And we're going to have to tolerate that. That's what democracy does. It can be messy. In the last 2016 national election, there were votes for Mickey Mouse and Jesus and a grilled cheese sandwich for president. Yeah. You know, people wrote those things in. So, you know, I'm not trying to say that our voting process should become acts of whimsy and mirth on the part of individuals with dementia. But I think, you know, calling them out as not making good choices, I find to be unduly shining a light upon one group of individuals when Americans in general have the right to make very bad choices in elections.
And also, too, it's important to point out that we're not knocking staff at long-term care facilities here. Anybody, you know, from any walk of life could unduly influence somebody who's vulnerable. So
precisely.
Okay, let's. We're going to take a quick station ID here, and then we're going to get to another call. You are listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. And let's get to Sarah, who's got another question or comment about this issue. Hello, Sarah.
Hi. I work on election boards, and a number of years ago, this came up because I live in a senior building. So I checked with the folks at the city commissioners, and in Philadelphia, unless you have been declared legally incompetent, you are entitled to vote.
That's right.
Okay.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
So
a couple of years, somebody's 12-year-old grandson assisted them.
So you live in a building for seniors, Sarah. Are you hearing concerns from any of them about the ability to vote or questions about the ballots, any concerns and their ability to cast a vote?
Well, most of the people in our building have requested mail-in ballots, but whether they've actually mailed them in is another question. It's like sometimes they have a home health aide assisting them. It's like they just, you know, it's like I've offered to take them into City Hall for them, but there's a special form I have to have signed because you're supposed to hand them in yourself.
Exactly. Sarah's raised a very interesting issue here, which is there's a mail-in ballot can, of course, be mailed in. You put it in the U.S. mail, and, you know, there's still time to do that. And, you know, if it's postmarked before Election Day, the ballot will be counted, assuming it arrives finally at the state. But the transport of a ballot by hand, ballots are considered, you know, sacred objects. And if you're going to take a ballot and hand it in at one of the voting stations, you have to hand in your ballot and only your ballot, not a bunch of other people's ballots. And so if you're going to deliver a ballot for someone else, which I, for example, did this weekend, I assisted a disabled voter, and I had to get a form that allowed me to have the permission to bring her ballot in. She signed the form, and I signed the form. And I took it to the Laura Curtis Center and handed in her ballot.
So a lot to work on in terms of making the voting process more accessible to vulnerable seniors. Sarah, thank you for the call. Let's get another one in, and welcome Terry to the Regional Roundup. Hi, Terry.
Hi, how are you? I just want to call to give a caregiver's perspective. I was caregiver for my mother for 10 years and watched her go through the various stages of Alzheimer's. And I would say at a point, I made the decision not to actively bring up the election because of her mental functioning. So I disagree with what your guest is saying. She didn't even know an election was happening. And I believe at some point she got so suggestible that if she walked into a voting booth, she would say, I don't know, what do you think? And I worried about her going in there and having somebody say, well, why don't you vote for this person? And she'd be like, okay.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's democracy. So I think that I would make the decision the same way again, knowing what I know, knowing what I saw, and I don't regret it.
Well, Terry, thanks for the call. Point well taken, Jason?
Point noted.
Noted.
in some sense, you know, what Terry laid out there was, I'm afraid that, you know, my mother would have, and by the way, I hear what Terry went through, not just around voting, but all the other challenges that caregivers face around the just deeply challenging moral and ethical decisions that seem ordinary but are quite extraordinary. And, you know, and one of them is voting, and there's no question I know exactly what Terry's describing. But in some sense, this works itself out. What do I mean by that? You know, so someone does assist Terry's mother voting, including, for example, Terry. And mother says, I don't know, what do you think I should do? What are you doing? Hmm. Again, you move on. You just skip it. And, you know, I think Terry's other point was, you know, my mother wasn't tracking the election, et cetera. You know, she's sort of getting at a very interesting issue, which is at what point do you sort of say, I need to hear you say, well, let's go vote, versus I say to you, you know, the election's coming. Do you want to vote? I think there's a reasonable space to occupy here. And that reasonable space is things like, you know, when a person moves, whether or not they want to register to vote. In the case of the current election, for example, applications for a mail-in ballot, I think people should be offered those opportunities when the rules change and or they're otherwise talking about the election. You know, who's this Trump guy? Well, he's president. You know, the election's coming. Do you want to vote? But if there's no engagement in the election, no discussion, I guess we could have a reasonable conversation about whether you feel you should even ask the person if they want to vote or not.
All right. Jason,
I think these things have a way of working out.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. We're grateful for your appearance here on the Regional Roundup. Really important information here.
Great.
Thanks so much. Jason Karlowicz is a co-director of the Penn Memory Center. You are listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Welcome back to the Regional Roundup. The Pew Center for Arts and Heritage is, in its own words, dedicated to fostering a vibrant cultural community in Greater Philadelphia. And every year, the center announces a series of grants to support the region's artists and cultural organizations. Among those chosen to receive a fellowship grant this year is Philadelphia poet Ara D. Matthews, author of the collection Simulacra and winner of the 2016 Yale Series of Younger Poets. Matthews is an assistant professor of creative writing at Bryn Mawr College, and she joins us now in the Regional Roundup. So nice to have you with us, Ara.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And our congratulations.
Thank you. I'm really excited.
I was going to say, tell us about the Pew Center grant and what this means to artists such as yourself.
Well, I mean, one of the things with artistry is that often it goes unnoticed. And the opportunity to be noticed in your field, or at least to be acknowledged in your field, is a huge boon for many artists. We create usually in isolation and with some degree of insularity, and our voice, our kind of inner voice, is the one that tells us that the work is okay and that the work should go forward. And sometimes it's nice to get outside validation and affirmation of how you spend your life, you know, and that's what the Pew is offering, this outside validation for the choices that I've made to be an artist and to be a writer. It's tremendous for me and for many others.
So this is from the Pew Center for Arts and Heritage website. Quote, aware of the challenges artists and institutions are now facing, we are humbled and inspired by their efforts to persevere and adapt to the conditions of a global pandemic. How has the pandemic affected or even shaped your work, if it has?
Tremendously, actually. So much of what I try to do is I care a lot about voices in my work. I care a lot about my own voice, but I also care a lot about the voices of my community or the voices that are around me, both historical and contemporary. And being inside for these many months has made me kind of fine-tune my voice to hear from myself a little bit more rather than listening to all of the voices around. I love persona work, and so it becomes a little less urgent when the voice that's inside your head or the voice that you hear is yours predominantly because of the degree of isolation that we're facing right now. But it also fine-tunes you to begin to think about how the world at large plays into our thoughts, our political identities, how it plays into the work, and to think a little bit more closely about the autobiographical I. We are all people that are living in an unprecedented time, in a very political time. And then what does that mean for the work? How does that come through in the work? So you may have had one idea about the direction that you were taking with the work, but the pandemic made many people, many artists, do an about face and turn their attentions to other things that were more pressing. Including these ideas of isolation, ideas of what the political moment means. What voice does the poet have in this political moment? And, you know, you begin to think of some of the great poets from Eastern European countries who were faced with great tumult and turmoil in their political landscapes and how they worked their way through it. So I've begun to, you know, read Russian authors and Polish poets and to be understanding of their environments and how their environments shape their work. And I'm very sensitive to that right now, thinking about the political culture, not just the I, but thinking about the I inside of the culture and how we face or how we determine to work through the issues of the day. And it's really in the work.
Let's take a look at some of your pre-pandemic work. Simulacrum means image or semblance of something, according to Webster's Dictionary. Simulacra is plural. Is this a good representation of the meaning of your collection entitled Simulacra?
Absolutely. My first book was, which was Simulacra, was a combination of philosophical and literary influences. It had voices from Ludwig Wittgenstein to Jean Baudrillard, Anne Sexton, Gertrude Stein. The title of the book itself was borrowed from Baudrillard's concept of the simulacrum, which is kind of a social critical construct in the ways in which reality is constructed and simulated. And so I tried to adapt those concepts and create an alternate reality through intertextual dialogue. I had dialogues with Anne Sexton, dialogues with Gertrude Stein. And they served for me as markers of social comparison and critique, but they also helped me to develop my own voice. And I think the first book also does that. It helps you to develop your own voice, the way that you want to go forward in the world. And I learned that I am, for better or worse, kind of a composite of all the voices that have come before me. And how do I honor that in the work? And Simulacra was really a way to try and honor that while still telling in confessional mode about my own life.
I believe the poem Etymology is part of this collection. Ara, would you read it for us?
Sure. Etymology. Because my mother named me after a child, born still to a godmother I've never met, I took another way to be known, something easier to remember, inevitable to forget, something that rolls over the surface of thrush because I grew tired of saying, no, it's pronounced. Now I'm tired of not conjuring that ghost I honor. Say it with me. Era. Rhymes with Sarah. Sarah from the Latin meaning a woman of high rank, which also means whenever I ask anyone to hold me in their mouth, I sound like what I almost am. Hear me out. I'm not a D or a river charging through working class towns where union folk cog wedge for plots and barely any house at all, where bosses mangle ethnic phonemes and nobody says one word because checks in the mail. So let's end this classist pretend where names don't matter and language is too heavy a lift. My E is silent, like most people should be. The consonant is sonorant, is a black woman, or one might say, the spine. I translate to wind in a country known for its iron, imply lioness of God in Jesus's tongue, mean apex predator, free of known enemy, fierce enough to harm or fast enough to run. This truth from now until. The tongue has no wings to flee what syllables it fears. The mouth is no womb, has no right to consume what it did not make.
Pulling from the poem, my mother named me after a child born still to a godmother I've never met. Era is, it's a beautiful name, and yet there's a heaviness, it seems, in your ownership of it. I'm tired of not conjuring that ghost I honor. Is this close to the meaning, or am I off base?
No, you're completely, you've nailed it. I mean, the meaning was that I had gone by my middle name for so long, my nickname, D, and adopted that middle name because I found it, I found it confounding that people, first you look at my name and it's very difficult to pronounce, but I didn't want to make people feel bad about mispronouncing my name when you look at it, and it's almost a phonetic impossibility on the page because there's an extra vowel in there. And so I thought, oh, just call me D. For the longest time, when I first started poetry, I just went by D. Matthews. And then it occurred to me that I have this name that's full of history, that has a meaning, meanings that I've come to adopt over time, because when I first, when you become aware of your name, you may go to a name dictionary to figure out what it means. But I didn't. I just thought that it was a constructed name. It didn't mean anything. I had to make my own meaning. But I found meaning. I began to research language and understand, okay, my name means something in a language that I don't speak. But it also means something because it has some kind of historical weight to it. The way in which you were named is almost as important as the name itself. And I just kind of wanted to honor that, to think about it more closely. I actually wrote that while I was in Edinburgh, and I was kind of correcting people about how to pronounce my name all the time. And I thought, I don't want to make them feel bad. But then I also make myself feel bad when I'm not called what it is that I was named. And so, you know, how do you balance that? And you balance that through teaching and showing people how to call, what to call you. And that's what the poem really is it's a way to teach and to lend a hand in understanding the origin of my name and why I go by.
So just one more quick question on this line.
Of course.
Are considering the origin of your name, are you now able to carry the history more lightly?
I can. I think when I first found out that I was named for a child that my godmother that died shortly after being born, and my mother took the name from my godmother. The reason I'd never met my godmother is because my mother stole the name from my godmother. So, you know, it's loaded with history and conflict and all of that stuff. And so I just kind of, I can carry it more lightly because I think that even in the heaviness of our past, the heaviness of our received histories, there's still something, there's light inside of it. And the light for me is that when I became older, I realized that Era means wind in Albanian. And I kind of like that. I love the connotation. Yes, that is exactly what I do. That is who I am. I shift as the wind shifts, and I believe myself to be powerful. And so I adopted that. I love the meaning, and I took it as my own. So I made the meaning as much as I inherited one.
So to the nuts and bolts, do you tell us about the process of starting with a blank screen or a piece of paper? Era, do you generally work because you feel the poem's already starting to form, the words for the most part flow, or is it a labor of love word by word and line by line?
I think some days it's a little bit of column A, a little bit of column B. There are those poems that come to you in a dream, or they come to you instantly and you're like, that's a poem. And then you get these other poems that you labor with for years. In my case, I can work on a poem like as Walt Whitman did, where he did Leaves of Grass. He edited Leaves of Grass for years until his death even. And so, you know, thinking about how do you make the poem better? How do you, so you're constantly going back and revisiting your poems. And inspiration doesn't, I can't work by inspiration, otherwise I would rarely work. So I just have to make it a labor of love and go in every day, try and write what I see, what I live, what I experience, what I see others experiencing and living, and then come back to it at some point and see where the poem or the direction of the writing might take this concept or this idea or this fragment or this nugget and hone it. And that's really the work, is like not thinking that it comes out in one swift gust of inspiration, but knowing that it's a labor and you kind of massage it and hew it over time. That's what I try and do.
So Ara, 2 years ago, a young man named Wes Matthews was named Philadelphia's Youth Poet Laureate. Wes is your son. So as a mom and a fellow poet, it must have been a pretty incredible moment for you.
Oh, just absolutely incredible. I'm so proud of him. He's now at the University of Pennsylvania and studying anthropology, and he has an incredible mind and has always had an incredible mind. I remember when he was in it was actually probably late elementary school going into early middle school. And he just kind of picked up a dictionary and started looking up the meanings of words. And so he always had this love of language. And unlike my upbringing, where I didn't really have books in the house, Wes always had books in the house everywhere. So he was picking up books and learning new things and writing about it and trying to see life not only through his eyes, but through the eyes of others, without, you know, making it into not a tourist history, but trying to really pay homage to people and their unique experiences and his own. And he's turned into being just a wonderful poet and, like, more importantly, just an incredible human being. I'm really proud that he's my son, and I'm proud of all he's accomplished.
Poet Ara D. Matthews is our guest. You are listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. So, Ara, you are an assistant professor of creative writing at Bryn Mawr College. What path do you recommend for students who are trying and maybe even struggling a bit to find their own particular voices?
Ah, that's a great question. Live. I think the most important thing, more than calling yourself a poet or a writer, is to be able to live your experiences fully, like just being present in your own life and noticing things, starting with a journal, writing things down, reading everything all the time, a wide berth of reading, not just narrow reading of poems and not just narrow readings of fiction, but reading everything. That's where I try and, you know, instill a love of reading and a love of experience with my students, and helping them to see it's not just what you've lived so far, it's what you will live. So the poem is not just one piece of time, it transcends time. It's both past, present, and future, all of those things at once. And to try and think of, you know, their lives in that way, and to reflect back, to be present in the moment, but also to look ahead. And just honor every single bit of experience that they have, and what, try and write it down, capture it. Be an archivist first, an archivist and a reader, and then you can be a poet.
What do you want people to take away from your work?
I just want them to take away a sense of ancestry and history. I care quite a bit about both. And then also to be able to think about how to play with forms. One of the things that's important in my work is my visual relationship to poems. I care a lot about what form looks like. I consider myself kind of in the school of the Black radical aesthetic. I care that that we're not thinking about poems kind of in this with a myopic view or monolithic view, and where it's got to be a certain way. It's either a sonnet or it's a villanelle. Or no, how do we create? We're constantly innovating. How do we create new forms and create new forces and rhythms inside of the poem? And how do we make those synthesize and reconcile in unexpected ways or even expected ways? So thinking about form is one of the things that is really important to me, and I try to be as wide-reaching as I possibly can and to think outside of the box, thinking about how poems can be code or thinking about how poems can be graphs or pictures, and in really trying to translate that well. I'm always thinking about the poem beyond the page.
So we only have about 15 seconds left. Can you tell us what's next, what you're working on now?
I am working on my second book. It's called Mundane Gods. It's a series of palimpsests, or overwritten texts, told in three parts. And it basically explores the spatial and racial realities of the American underclass and working class.
All right. Thank you so much, Ara D. Matthews. It was really great to meet you.
Really great to meet you. Thank you for having me.
Ara D. Matthews is the recipient of a 2020 Pew Center Fellowship Grant and author of the collection Simulacra. And as always, we invite you to visit with us on social media. Simply head to whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today has been Adam Staniszewski. Our producer is John Ahrens. And I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks for joining us. Be well.